advice in this pandemic is simple. Wash your hands. Cold comfort, though, to many.
40% of the world's population, or roughly 3 billion people, do not have a hand-washing facility with soap and water at home.
Also, the Uber driver dilemma, stop earning a paycheck or keep working and risk getting infected by the coronavirus.
When you look at the numbers, every ride is a roll of the dice. You never know who's infected or not, so we'll see what happens.
And college students across the U.S. are being told to go home and learn online. For many international students, that's led to huge headaches.
My schedule here will be upside down. I will have to be awake at night and sleep during the days in order to attend classes.
I'm Marco Werman. Today, we are all about the coronavirus on The World. Everybody everywhere is discussing one thing. So today, our entire program is looking at how the world is dealing with the coronavirus outbreak. We begin with our own Ilana Gordon, who covers public health for The World. You're in isolation. I haven't seen you since last Friday. What a week.
It has been quite a week.
Give us a global view today, Ilana. What's changed this week with the spread of the virus?
Right now, more than 210,000 cases have been reported to the WHO, confirmed cases of this new coronavirus, and more than 9,000 people have died. But the story of this pandemic, it's really different depending on where you are. Bill Hanich is with the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics at Harvard.
The interesting thing we're seeing is that the outbreaks are happening in multiple places, and the number of places where they're happening are multiplying. However, they're not happening at the same pace everywhere.
So scientists like Bill are trying to figure out why that is. But if you look at this week, for example, China hit a major milestone. It saw no new reported cases for the first time from local infections. I mean, that's a really big deal. And then on the other hand, if you looked at a place like Italy, it also reached a milestone, but a much more grave one. They had more reported deaths than in China right now, with more than 3,500 lives lost.
One grim detail from Italy, reportedly they don't even have room for bodies at the local crematories in the north. Ilana, what more did we learn about the coronavirus this week in terms of some of the biggest developments in the science?
It is a fire hose of information, Marco. So one thing that we do know in the bigger picture globally that the WHO keeps stressing is that everything that we do now, everything to stop the transmission of every single case, any case, just one case, can have a massive consequence down the road. But there have been more data coming out that look at who's being most impacted. And one of the messages this week is that while older people appear to be most impacted, younger people are not invincible. There are reports that people, for example, between the ages of 20 and 45 are also being hospitalized, although at a lower percentage. When it comes to treatments, there's been a lot of preliminary research on possible drugs that can help. Again, these are very small samples in early stages. I talked to Dr. Kritika Kupali. She's vice chair of the Infectious Disease Society of America's Global Health Committee. And here's something that she's hopeful about.
I think the other really exciting piece of news this week is the fact that they started their vaccine trial, and the first person got the first dose of the mRNA vaccine.
This is like an unprecedented race to get a vaccine and to go right to testing in humans while simultaneously testing in animals is a big deal.
So a glimmer of hope there. Ilana, as you look ahead, what are some of the key things you want to really get your head around?
There's still a lot we don't know. For example, why in places like Japan, the case count is far less than other places? Why are so many health workers in Italy being infected? It appears to be more than those in China. While we know that young people are at risk, many appear to not show symptoms. So one thing scientists don't have a handle on yet is how much kids transmit this. And so there's a lot to be keeping an eye out for.
The World's Ilana Gordon covers public health. Thank you very much for your insights, Ilana. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Marco.
This afternoon, President Trump announced that he's invoking the Defense Production Act. Under the law, the government can direct industries to ramp up production of necessary equipment.
We're using the act. The act is very good for things like this. We have millions of masks that we've ordered. They will be here soon. We're having them shipped directly to states.
Trump has said he would use the Defense Production Act as needed. Julia Kayyem is a former Department of Homeland Security advisor, now at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. The Defense Production Act was enacted at the beginning of the Korean War in 1950, Juliet. What is it supposed to do?
So it gives a president authority to do two things as regards the private sector. One is to simply acquire from them, we have to pay, but acquire from them goods that they may already have. The other is that it can force or compel manufacturing requirements from manufacturers.
So a clothing factory, for example, might be asked to crank out a bunch of masks, face masks.
That would be exactly the expectation at this stage.
But we're hearing mixed messages from the White House. Is it still clear as to whether the DPA is in effect?
So the Protection Act has two parts. The first is a president invokes it. Clearly, Donald Trump has done that. It has a second part, which is it has to be executed. What do you need? What companies have it? And have you commanded the companies to do it? That part has not happened. We're at the surge stage, right? So we activated, meaning all of us are home. We're going to protect each other. And now we have to surge resources to these states and locals who are getting hit on the front line, as we've seen in Italy and elsewhere, with what they need.
What other powers does the Defense Production Act give the president? And in a crisis, is there a risk of overreach with any of those other powers?
The Defense Production Act basically allows the president to take charge of essentially a private company's business plan. And you don't take over the company. You just sort of say, okay, instead of keeping this, we're going to take it. And everyone's compensated. So it's not a stealing. It's just a way of a president getting manufacturing or other resources. So I'm asked this question a lot, like about the overreach. Doesn't this all seem shocking? No one who saw what was happening in China or Italy would say that the criticism is the United States overreacting at this stage. We don't have a national effort. We have a president who's still not able to speak honestly about either deficiencies in masks or what's coming down the pike. I do think the American public is in a little bit of shock right now. And part of that, I think, comes from the failure of the president to, I think, get us ready for this.
Juliette Kayyem was with Homeland Security under Barack Obama. She's now at Harvard's Kennedy School. Thank you very much, as always, Juliette.
Thank you so much.
Hospital workers are bravely on the front lines of this pandemic, but they're not the only ones taking risks. Think about all the taxi drivers and people working for rideshare companies. The World's Orla Barry in London has their story.
Peter is an Uber driver in Seattle.
Hey, Peter.
Hey, can you hear me okay?
Like the other drivers I speak with for this story, he doesn't want me to use his full name and worries about getting in trouble with the company.
I'm just pulling in right now. So
when I get hold of him on the phone, Peter tells me he's having a dilemma.
I went ahead and canceled that order and left it as close to the apartment gate as I could get without having to touch anything. I know that sounds ridiculously paranoid, but I don't think I'll be doing any more deliveries. It's just not worth it.
Peter has just made a delivery to a customer in the city, but she wanted him to leave the package inside her apartment building because she can't go outside.
And I said, well, you know, as an Uber driver, that means we've got to touch all these surfaces just to get to you. It's not safe. If you really can't meet me curbside, I'm going to have to cancel the order. She said, okay, fine, go ahead and cancel.
This is a problem facing drivers like Peter right now. Seattle has one of the highest COVID-19 infection rates in the US. And Peter says he's worried about getting infected himself. But not all Uber drivers feel the same.
I'm not worried at all, other than the complete headlessness of everybody around me who are doing some very bizarre, irrational things, like filling their cars with toilet paper as if they have dysentery.
This is Emma. She's an Uber driver in London. When I speak with her, she tells me she has two new rules for anyone who wants to get into her car.
I don't pick up anybody with a face mask on or anybody with toilet roll in their bags, right? Because I'm not colluding with this absolute insanity.
But a few days later, Emma messages me to say her attitude is changing. The British Prime Minister has announced more stringent measures aimed at limiting social contact in the UK. And now many workers, like Emma, are starting to grow more concerned. Ray Barbrook is an Uber driver in Wales who says he's been worried since the very start of the outbreak. He goes by the nickname Karaoke Ray because he does live karaoke sessions in his Uber. That's Ray singing with one of his passengers recently. At this point, though, Ray says his biggest worry is his own health.
I'm very worried, actually, because of my age. I'm 70, and I've got asbestosis in my lungs. And I am worried if I get that, I'm not going to survive.
Ray contacted Uber, his employer, to tell them about his concerns. But he says he wasn't impressed by the response. Ray's concerns are the same as some of the other Uber drivers that I speak with. Many of them don't want to talk on tape. Max Dewhurst is with the Independent Workers Union of Great Britain, which represents many drivers and delivery workers. Dewhurst says most Uber drivers simply live from one paycheck to the next.
We're not talking about people with thousands and thousands of pounds of savings in the bank. We're talking people that will rapidly get into debt from not having money coming in.
When I contact the company, Uber says no representative is available to speak with me. In a statement, it says Uber plans to compensate drivers if they're forced to self-isolate for 14 days. But Dewhurst says it's just not acceptable. In Seattle, Peter says he's appreciative of Uber's efforts. But he says the reality for drivers like him is that not working is simply not an option.
I think those of us who are doing it as our sole source of income are going to do it until somebody tells us to stop or until we actually fall ill. I know that sounds callous, but I think right now some of us don't really have an option financially. That's, you know, we either work or we starve to death. So.
For some drivers, the drop in business has already been dramatic. Ciro Lamota is a taxi driver in Naples. And as it turns out, Cabiocchi Ray isn't the only one singing behind the wheel.
Stars spreading the news. I'm living today.
Lamota serenades his customers, mainly tourists, as he drives them around the Amalfi coast of Italy. But when we talk, Lamota says he hasn't been singing for a while because Italy is in lockdown. He says most of his customers have been cancelling their trips altogether.
Probably 95% is based on tourism. So this means that the season for me was starting and the coronavirus has arrived here now.
Lamota says Naples feels empty right now because of the coronavirus and it's hard to witness. But he says the authorities are doing the right thing.
I like to see that they close everything. Yeah.
The government should shut everything down.
Yeah.
Even though you would lose all business.
Well, exactly.
Lamota says that's the only way to stop the spread of the virus in Italy. A day after talking to Cabiocchi Ray in Wales, he messages me to say he's putting the car karaoke thing on pause for now. He says it's too much of a health risk passing the microphone from one passenger to the next. London driver Emma tells me she's now accepting passengers with face masks, because so many people are now wearing them. And in Seattle, Peter says he's done with doing deliveries for Uber Eats, but he's still driving passengers for the moment.
When you look at the numbers, every ride is a roll of the dice. You never know who's infected or not. So we'll see what happens.
For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Simba Bonga, Simba Bonga, Simba Bonga.
The upbeat rhythm of Congolese soukous. This is Orlus Mabile. He'd been living in Paris for several years. He'd had a stroke several months ago. We learned this morning that he died, age 67. Mabile's daughter and some of his fans posted to social media that Mabile had succumbed to complications from COVID-19. His manager said that was not the case. Whatever the cause, the best way we can honor Orlus Mabile today is to hear his voice. The late Orlus Mabile there. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Let's take a look at another global crisis, climate change, and what we're learning about it from the coronavirus outbreak. That's what we're tackling today in a segment we're calling The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
In the effort to slow down the spread of the coronavirus, flights around the world are grounded. You may be working from home and not driving. When was the last time you gassed up your car? The social distancing is good not just for public health, it's also good for your carbon footprint. The world's Anna Kussmer joins me now. So, Anna, when we talk about the global carbon emission impact of the response to this coronavirus, what do all these behavior changes add up to?
The biggest impact when it comes to the environment is the economy. When the economy changes so drastically, there's going to be huge changes in the environment as well. The more a country's economy is reliant on carbon, on oil and gas, the greater the drop in emissions when a huge recession hits like we're seeing now. China, in the month of February, saw a 25% drop in carbon emissions compared to usual. That's mostly due to a drop in manufacturing. Scientists are expecting a similar drop all around the world. This is also translating to things like air pollution. I talked to a transportation economist in Italy named Marco Percoco, and he says air pollution in northern Italy and Wuhan are way down.
In the past few centuries, we could not observe something like this. It's really a sudden shock, and it's very concentrated.
So, Anna, it sounds weird to ask, but is the coronavirus good for the environment?
It's really tempting to want to draw that conclusion, particularly with all the bad news. Want to see some kind of silver lining. But there's no indication that any of these positive impacts will last. This is really a short-term dynamic. And that's because nothing in the system is actually changing. And emissions aren't down because of well-designed energy and environmental policy. When the economy rebounds, pollution will come back, and it could get even worse.
Well, I know humans are prone to repeating mistakes of the past, but how could it get worse?
An economic meltdown is really bad for the renewable energy sector. It's going to be harder to finance those projects and to also source materials for renewable energy. And finally, I'm sure as you've noticed, this pandemic is taking up pretty much everyone's attention right now. Climate action requires a lot of political will, and it loses momentum as an issue as the whole world rallies around this other problem.
So your point is that the coronavirus may not be the pivot moment for climate change that many think it might be. Could there be any upside of the virus for the environment?
After economic recessions come stimulus packages from governments. That's when governments inject money into the economy to try to kickstart industries. The European Central Bank and the U.S. already have planned packages of hundreds of billions of dollars. Those packages could have some kind of upshot for the environment. I spoke to Fatih Birol. He's the director of the International Energy Agency in Paris. And he said he's calling for governments all over the world to use those stimulus packages to fund large-scale renewable energy projects like huge solar wind farms, things like that.
This is a very important opportunity. Important thing is that we launch sustainable stimulus packages focused on clean energy technologies.
When we have a big disruption like we're seeing now, there are also huge opportunities for change, and that could apply to lots of different things, particularly climate.
The world's Anna Kussmer checking in with us from her remote studio. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Marco. Stay safe.
You too. The U.S.-Canada border is basically closed. That's a big disruption for the people of Windsor, Ontario. On the other side of the river from Windsor, Detroit. The two cities are connected by a bridge and tunnel. Drew Dilkins is the mayor of Windsor.
We like to say we're the place where Canada starts. And folks here are just used to shopping, buying gas, going over for groceries, going over for lunch to Detroit, and then coming back to Windsor. We're that close. And the economies are so tightly integrated and the supply chains for business are so tightly integrated that it will be a bit of a disruption for people who are used to that kind of movement. But positive to know that essential workers will still be able to cross the border. And of course, all trade is still able to cross into Canada and into the United States.
So there are exceptions to the border closure, like nurses and medical professionals.
It is absolutely essential that some of these workers be able to cross the border. And we just look back not too long ago, what happened just shortly after 9/11, where there was a temporary border closure. But then the wait times to get staff to move through the border after 9/11, it could take 5 or 6 hours because there was such great inspection going on both sides of the border that hospitals in the city of Detroit were actually talking about renting helicopters and renting boats to be able to bring healthcare workers that live in our community across to the city of Detroit to make sure that they could continue their operations.
Yeah, so tell us a bit more about Windsor and its connection to Detroit. Do you get commuters coming from the U.S. to Windsor every day as well?
Yeah, there are about 800 folks who cross from Michigan into Windsor every day for work, and about 6,000 that cross from Windsor into Detroit. And so the economies are so tightly integrated, and you have deep family relationships over time. History and geography have sort of created that down here with us and the folks in Detroit. And so you have really tight connections on both sides of the border. And we'd really look at the border as just a necessary thing to go through to get to the other side. And it's just seen as a natural extension of the state of Michigan. And so I've always said that the best part of living in the city of Windsor is you have this great, safe, small town Canadian feel. But when I want professional sports, NFL, NBA, all of that is literally 10 minutes away through the border in Detroit.
Mayor Dilkins, you must be pretty happy that people seem to be taking the stay-at-home protocol seriously. So has traffic pretty much stopped? The bridge and tunnel, close to zero cars in it right now?
You're seeing people who have to go to work still crossing, but there are zero wait times. You see traffic going back and forth, truck traffic, deliveries, of course, going both ways. So that hasn't stopped. And of course, it's probably, if I look at this, slightly increased because there's been such a demand on grocery and places like Costco and Walmart for supplies that they're working as fast as they can to get supplies to market. But commuter traffic definitely has ground almost to a halt.
Detroit is, of course, Motor City, but the automotive sector is just as important to Ontario as it is to Michigan. It's like a single economy. What is this moment doing to the car business?
Detroit is the automotive capital of the U.S., and Windsor is the automotive capital of Canada. And it's not a surprise that that's the way, because the supply chains for the automotive industry are so tightly integrated that, you know, I guess the best example to say is that the average part that goes into a car that rolls off the final assembly on the line crosses the border 6 to 8 times before it gets put into the car that rolls off the line. Because the big three has really closed down operations until the end of the month, certainly we're seeing a stop there. I think, you know, in some ways, the world, at least our world here, is just everyone's taking a pause.
Mayor, you're at home, and it's my understanding that you are currently in self-quarantine over COVID-19. Were you diagnosed positively?
No, I've not had a test, and myself and my family feel completely fine. We took the precaution because we had a trip to Jordan in the Middle East, and although that was a very low-risk country, the recommendations from the medical officers of health here is that if you've traveled outside of Canada, that you should quarantine or self-isolate for 14 days. So we're just, you know, we're, I guess, showing leadership and showing folks what they should do, despite the fact that we all feel completely healthy and completely fine and don't think that we have caught this virus.
I like that positivity. Drew Dilkins, the mayor of Windsor, Ontario, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
News headlines are just across our bridge. You're with the world. President Trump touts a drug to treat COVID-19. Problem is, it doesn't.
Ethically, you can't, you shouldn't, you mustn't false promise, which is what the president did and got me very angry about that.
And across Europe, people woke up to this today.
When you walk through a storm.
Solidarity through music, still ahead here on The World. There are a lot of unknowns with the coronavirus outbreak. At the top of that list, when will we have an effective treatment? President Trump is touting some breakthrough drug therapies and exaggerated the promise of a drug used to treat malaria, chloroquine.
We're going to be able to make that drug available almost immediately. And that's where the FDA has been so great. They've gone through the approval process. It's been approved.
To be clear, no drug has been approved. Art Kaplan is a bioethicist at New York University and one of the nation's top pioneers in compassionate use policy. I asked him why chloroquine was being associated with COVID-19.
There was a paper that came out of China involving a tiny number of subjects, a poor study that indicated they thought it had some benefit in people who had had COVID-19 infection, who had the coronavirus. Hardly any legitimate evidence. It just made people think maybe there's something there. So he misspoke when he said the FDA fast-tracked this or did anything. The drug's been approved for 50 years. He misspoke when he said it's available to treat coronavirus infection. That is absolutely not true, not because the drug isn't out there, but because he has no idea if it works. And there are at least 4 or 5 places actively trying to initiate studies right now of that drug.
So language is super important at uncertain times, and especially at uncertain kind of medical crisis times like this. So what should a president be saying scientifically, ethically, about potential therapies for the coronavirus?
Ethically, you can't, you shouldn't, you mustn't false promise, which is what the president did and got me very angry about that. You have people in beds who are dying, their families hear the president say there's something available to treat them, and they start begging the doctor to get it when there isn't anything. So morally, you cannot overpromise. You're betraying the hope that people have who are facing death or long hospitalizations from this virus. Scientifically, you should be listening to your FDA director, listening to your NIH personnel, because they can tell you what the real deal is. The FDA commissioner attempted to correct Trump's misinformation when he spoke. But again, I don't think they're using the scientists, the CDC, the NIH properly. If you will, the president should be up there saying, I think there's some research that might be hopeful, and I'm going to turn it over to the FDA director to tell us what the status of the research is, rather than getting up there and saying cures are on the shelves now.
The president also spoke about compassionate use of different therapies for individuals who are near death. I mean, this is your specialty. Explain how that would work.
So there are ways to fast track drugs. The old standard way, non-emergency, is you test them on animals, you safety test them in humans, and then you do a what everybody thinks of as the controlled trial with a placebo to see whether it works and whether it's safe. But oftentimes, like in a pandemic or when someone is dying, we don't have time to do the normal clinical trial. The FDA will permit a fast track called compassionate use and say, if you want to prescribe something, even unapproved, we will allow you to do that as long as the drug manufacturer will make it available to you. If they will, the FDA approval rate in those situations of letting the doctor prescribe the drug, 99.6%. They're not in the way. They want to cooperate. But companies won't give things out if they think they're not established as safe because they don't want the liability, perhaps. Or they're trying to get the drug approved and they may only have a small amount in supply. And so they think it's better to get drug to more people by getting FDA approval and trying to give it away to the desperate.
Art Kaplan is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University's Grossman School of Medicine. Thank you very much for your explanations.
Thank you.
The public health mantra of this pandemic is wash your hands. It is, we are told repeatedly, one of the most important things you can do to control the spread of any virus. But what if you can't wash your hands because you don't have access to clean water or soap? Kellyanne Naylor is chief of water, sanitation, and hygiene at UNICEF.
40% of the world's population, or roughly 3 billion people, do not have a hand washing facility with soap and water at home. And even more surprising is nearly 3/4 of the people in least developed countries lack basic hand washing facilities at home.
That is astonishing. 40%. So like 3 billion, nearly half of the planet. What are the parts of the world where this is a problem?
Out of the 78 countries that collected data last year, we found that 42 of those countries, less than half of the population, actually had a basic hand washing facility at home. And, you know, 19 of those countries where there were no hand washing facility at home, these countries are primarily in sub-Saharan Africa, as well as a few countries in Latin America, Asia, and the Middle East as well.
So what are the implications of that limited water supply in many parts of the world for the spread of the coronavirus?
You know, UNICEF has been working, we work on water and sanitation in over 100 countries. So it's just every day we're getting in more and more country response plans talking about what's happening on the ground. When you're going through public places or airports, you can see lots of signage reminding people about making sure that they do this practice. I think another thing that we're seeing increasingly, especially in areas where maybe hand washing facilities don't already exist, are campaigns means to really put in place dedicated hand washing facilities in critical locations. And this could be public spaces or markets, and those need to be regularly maintained to be able to be effective. But it just helps making sure that when people arrive and leave from different public spaces, that they can wash their hands.
Yeah, I recently saw, I think it was in Rwanda, a setup of hand washing stations in a bus station, and a lot of people were using them. I mean, that must have pleased you.
Yeah, I also had the opportunity to serve with UNICEF during the West Africa Ebola outbreak in 2014 and 2015. And when I was working in Liberia, it just became a way of life that these hand washing facilities were set up. I was happy recently to go back and to see that they were still there. And I think that's one of the things that we think can be an important outcome from this crisis, is just that, as you said, it really heightens people's awareness about the importance of this as not only a practice when there's a disease outbreak, but really something that can have a positive impact on preventing all sorts of diseases that are passed through, you know, contact with hands and mouth contact.
Kellyanne Naylor is Chief of Water Sanitation and Hygiene at UNICEF. Thank you very much for this.
Thank you. And wash your hands.
The State Department sent a message of relief for some Americans abroad in Morocco. The kingdom canceled flights in and out of the country last weekend. Hundreds of U.S. citizens, mostly tourists, were suddenly stuck. But now the State Department says it's going to help them get home. From the Moroccan capital, Rabat, Sebastian Boknight has our story.
You've probably heard some honeymoon horror stories, but Noah Prelinger has a pretty good one. He's a jazz musician from Boston. Prelinger and his new spouse, Nera Pekmez, flew to Morocco earlier this month.
The honeymoon was actually amazing.
But then Nera got scratched by a cat and started feeling sick.
My wife, we think, got rabies. We had to go to 4 hospitals in 2 different cities.
Scary, for sure. But they thought, let's just cut the trip short, fly home to Boston, and get treatment there, right?
The Moroccan government said by tomorrow, no more rescue flights are allowed to come here. And we're going to be shutting down the borders for 4 weeks.
All of a sudden, they were stuck. And far from alone, it turns out. Something like 3,000 American travelers this week found themselves stranded here in Morocco with no way out. In the last few days, tourists from several countries, Belgium, Britain, Turkey, were able to get out on emergency flights home. But Prelinger and other Americans who reached out to the U.S. Embassy in Morocco either never heard back or worse.
The U.S. Embassy gave us misinformation and we missed our ticket out of here. It's just really disappointing that our own government, supposedly the most important country in the world, isn't even helping their own people get out of here.
Everything that they've issued has actually potentially caused more problems than it's added any support.
That's Mary Marland. She came here for a friend's wedding with 2 young kids. Marland says the American embassy started tweeting about flights 2 days after Morocco closed its borders. The advice was to hitch a ride on one of the British flights and then find a way back to the States from London. Thankfully, she says, stranded travelers here started a group on Facebook. People were sharing reliable information about places to stay and flights out of the country.
Everyone has been wonderful with each other. If I did not have that group, I honestly feel like I'd have 0 information at all.
This week, things in Morocco have come to a halt. Restaurants and cafes closed. Public gatherings are banned. People are only allowed to leave home for food, essential work, and medical care. But stranded Americans I've spoken with say that locals have been extremely kind during all of this. Emily Rosenthal is here with a tour group. She says their guides have been trying to arrange flights home for everyone.
In our group, there are 14 of us, and we are all age 65 plus in the high risk category, some with underlying medical conditions. We're trying very hard not to panic.
During a news conference yesterday in Washington, President Trump was asked about the Americans still stuck in Morocco.
What can be done?
We know about it. We have groups. We have a group of young people in Peru, and we're working on taking care of that with the military.
On Thursday, some Americans started negotiating flights home at inflated prices. Then came an email from the State Department early this morning. Flights to the U.S. were scheduled for today, with a one-night layover in London. One guy I spoke with here tells me he's not thrilled about the idea of flying right now, and especially via Europe, which has so many coronavirus cases. But he does want to get home. I also got this voice message from Noah, the newlywed from Boston.
We made it on the plane. We're heading to London and then hopefully to Boston tomorrow. Words can't describe what we're feeling.
For The World, I'm Sebastian Boeknight in Rabat, Morocco.
Governments everywhere are trying to get a handle on who has the coronavirus and how it's spreading. Last night, Israel's Supreme Court told the government there it was going too far. Israel has been using a controversial surveillance program that tracks infected people as well as those who might have COVID-19. Protests erupted this week outside of Israel's parliament in Jerusalem. Hundreds of people shouting shame. To understand why Israel's program is so controversial, we reached out to Karen Elazari. She's a cybersecurity researcher at Tel Aviv University.
So what we know at the moment about these new emergency regulations allowing the Israeli police forces and the Israeli security agency to actually use location information gathered from cellular phones by the cellular companies to track confirmed patients, confirmed COVID carriers, to track their movements and to identify where they may have spread the virus, but also to contact potential people who may have contracted it and receive text messages from the Ministry of Health informing them that they were in close vicinity with a confirmed COVID carrier and that they must enter home isolation and 14-day quarantine.
So, Karen, let me just clarify. It's not just people who are tested positive who are tracked, but people who may have been in proximity with those positive tested people?
That's absolutely right. And so far, this has been limited for about 30 days, potentially 60 days in some cases. But the government can also choose to extend these new measures indefinitely. And there's really not a lot of oversight. This is warrantless surveillance. It doesn't require a warrant. It's sort of, I wouldn't call it blanket surveillance, but it's using capabilities that have existed for years, mainly for counterterrorism and for criminal investigations. And they're now being utilized in this civilian social healthcare crisis.
And those patients, do they have any choice in being tracked or not?
One of the issues raised in the Supreme Court discussion of the matter, the question was, couldn't this have been done as an opt-in instead of opting in effectively the entire country, 9 million Israelis? Another concern is, of course, the fact that this was passed by an interim government, an unelected government, and without really getting the Knesset Subcommittee for Intelligence Services and Secret Services, which only had 1 hour to discuss this on Monday before the Knesset was disbanded, and they couldn't reach a conclusion. So this was effectively done without their approval.
This surveillance, I understand, is nothing new. This data was being collected by the Shin Bet, Israel's intelligence agency, from like 2002. So the big difference this time is that it's being used much more widely.
This information, as you clearly stated, Marco, is not new information. The data is gathered originally by the cellular providers. And this is something that happens almost in every country where they have that sort of information. For potential investigative purposes, if the police or the Shin Bet requests it, but also for their operational purposes. So having that capability of tracking the movements of people based on their phones, that in of itself is not groundbreaking. What's happening right now is that the access for that type of data has been really opened up to police investigators, to the Shin Bet, and to people working in the Ministry of Health. And I'm not against that utilization. And many privacy advocates will tell you that they're not against the utilization per se. Israelis are no strangers to the specter of fear. And we're no strangers to emergency situations, war times, terrorism threats. We're used to living under potential existential threats. What we are raising the alarm about is the way that this process took place, the fact that it bypassed the Knesset committee that was supposed to authorize it, and the concern that this might be one step in a very slippery slope in a country that hasn't had an elected government for almost a year. The feeling here in Israel, for many Israelis, is that we are losing the grip of our very, very fragile democracy within this crisis.
Karen Elazari is a cybersecurity researcher at Tel Aviv University. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Marco.
As we all deal with the fallout from the pandemic, one group has been hit especially hard: international students at American universities. Some of them are struggling to find new local housing as colleges shut down the dorms. Others are returning to their home countries. And as online classes ramp up, that's bringing new headaches. The World's Rupa Shenoy has our story.
International students had to make quick decisions that may have consequences for years to come.
Everything changed, you know? I felt there was only bad choices.
Israeli grad student Becheva Baraban was part of a close-knit community of international students at Harvard's School of Education.
All the international students didn't know what to do. Suddenly, all of the people were considering their option, like, should I go? Should I stay? The borders are closing. We don't know what's happening.
Baraban chose to go to Singapore, where her husband is living. She says she was on the last flight into that country before its airport closed. She doesn't have much stuff with her.
I feel like a refugee.
At Kansas State University, Indian student Vedant Kulkarni decided to stay on a campus that now seems like a ghost town.
I see all these local American students, they're putting all these stories about how staying with their families, driving them crazy and whatnot. And I'm just like, dude, you have some family support over here. And imagine for students who are from halfway across the world.
Kulkarni's anxious about classes starting next week as Kansas State, like most colleges, shifts to teaching online.
It's been a bit of a chaos because of all the emails that all professors are sending and the different requirements each professor has with their online classes.
Kulkarni could have had a much bigger problem. His international student visa usually doesn't allow more than one class online. Rachel Banks says that was a widespread concern among students and administrators. She's director of public policy for the Association of International Educators.
Recognizing that their schools were going to put all courses online, would that put them out of status? Would they be in violation of their status if they had to be taking all their classes online?
Earlier this month, her group put those questions to the Department of Homeland Security. DHS said they would temporarily change the visa rules so that international students could continue all their classes online. The move was hailed by the President's Alliance on Higher Education and Immigration. Miriam Feldblum is executive director.
But then another issue of confusion came up when there was the question of, well, what happens if international students go back home while they're taking online classes?
So DHS addressed that too. They said that temporarily, international students could go back home, take online classes, and keep their U.S. visa.
So that was great news.
There still may be practical problems for, say, Chinese students, who make up a third of international students in the U.S. at nearly 400,000. The problem? Government censorship. Tony Chu, an undergrad at NYU, thinks it would be really difficult for him to participate in online classes if he went back home to China. He'd have to set up a VPN or virtual private network to get around Chinese internet censors.
It's harder to get onto American website when I'm in China. Especially a lot of schools are using like Google Gmail. So we can't really use Gmail in China.
Administrators across the U.S. are trying to find a way around that, but they haven't had much time to work on it. Chu has chosen to stay in the U.S. to make things easier, but he's skeptical about all the plans for online learning.
To be honest, no one really pays attention in online classes. You don't feel the need to like actually listen or focus because the professor can't really see you.
He says everyone he knows plays games during online classes. In Singapore, Becheva Baraban has the opposite problem.
My schedule here will be upside down. I will have to be awake at night and sleep during the days in order to attend classes.
Some lectures will be recorded and can be watched later, but Baraban's classes are interactive, where students make presentations and talk in small groups.
So if I want to feel at least that I'm in some way participating and gaining something from the classes, I have to do them live.
She says she'll make it work because she has to. The hardest part, Baraban says, is not knowing when all of this will end. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
We want to stay positive throughout these dark days, so let me share with you what happened this morning on radio airwaves across Europe.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high.
Jerry and the Pacemakers, that other band from Liverpool, and their 1963 hit, You'll Never Walk Alone. dozens of stations across Europe in the Netherlands, Luxembourg, Germany, Austria, Belgium, Bulgaria, Finland, Latvia, Slovakia. Who didn't play this song today? They ended up playing it all at the same time. This was Sander Hoogendoorn's idea. He's a DJ in the Netherlands at 3FM. Sander, how did all this start?
Actually, it started on Monday. We had here in the Netherlands, we had a sort of thing that everybody was like called to applaud for people who are working in healthcare, who are working in the hospitals to maybe save our people. Mm. So at 8 o'clock, everybody went outside and started clapping their hands. And I became so emotional because it was such a beautiful moment. And then I thought, well, what can I do as a radio DJ? Can I tag along, do something like this? And I just made some calls, sent some texts to my radio friends from other radio stations. And they were all enthusiastic right away.
And why Jerry and the Pacemakers, You'll Never Walk Alone?
Well, it was a song that my dad used to play when I was really young, and he was singing it, and I always remembered that. And it's just a beautiful song in times where you need hope, you know?
What's been the reaction from listeners? What have you heard?
Oh, I got so many emails and so many texts and tweets. People who were in tears, people who were sitting alone on the couch because they had to work at home, people who are working in healthcare, they have to work day and night to get this crisis down. Lots of beautiful reactions. And that is really beautiful that like an old medium like the radio, the old airwaves, you know, it still in 2020 can bring people together.
You're a DJ, Sander. What is it about music that just works to raise people's spirits at a time like this?
You see that really music, it brings people together. And that is so, so nice for me as a radio DJ as well. I get to play beautiful music every day, what gives hope. But sometimes it's just a nice song to forget the world we are in for maybe 4 minutes.
Sander Hoogendoorn at Dutch radio station 3FM. Sander, thank you very much. It was great to speak with you.
Thank you.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studio, letting you know that we're always with you, I'm Marco Werman. Stay strong and smart, everyone. We'll see you back here Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.